Hi, everyone. My name is Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. Joining for the second time this week, again, unexpected, but this was an important one because we have Jack Encarnacio with us. Jack was the very first guest on this podcast. Jack also worked with Jordan Breen, who I did a small mini podcast about earlier this week, sharing his thoughts on how he'd explain pro wrestling to a non-wrestling fan. And so initially, I had to reach out to Jack, and the timing wasn't right. And they reached out and he said, yeah, I would like to share some thoughts about Jordan now that I have a few days to kind of think about some things. And that's what happened. Jack and I talked for almost an hour, and it was a pretty wide ranging conversation about his history with Jordan, how he got to know him, the uniqueness that made him what he was in the MMA media space. And we also, it kind of delved into like Sherdog and the history of Sherdog, what happened that Sherdog changed course so quickly, and kind of the guts of it really were extracted, and the soul of it was really extracted, and kind of how things are covered today and all these things. So this is a real fun conversation. We even get into a little Laps fan stuff at the very end. So yeah, I want to share this. It's a great conversation. So let me get right to it. Yours truly and Jack Encarnacio on the life of times of Jordan Breen and some other things as well. Enjoy. Well, for the first time since April, Jack Encarnacio, the Laps fan, returns. No JP Sorrow this week. Jordan Breen passed away. We learned his passing earlier this week. And Jack was actually the first person I reached out to talk about him, because he worked, he worked alongside him for so long. Sherdog knew him so well and all that. But yeah, before we get to that, Jack, how are things going?
They're okay. You know, this is really sad situation with Jordan. It had been years since I talked to him. I was not the closest person you can find to him, so I need to stipulate right up front those things. But the capacity in which I worked with him, I feel like I got a pretty unique window into why he's so well remembered and why these tributes just started pouring out from all corners of the MMA community upon learning of his death. So glad to have the chance to share what I saw of a pretty special guy.
Yeah, and I think it is. There's so many, and I didn't know him that well. There's so many thoughts that go through in a week, and takes you back to a certain era in MMA, a certain era in MMA media, and how it was covered, and just how distinctly different it is now. Yeah. Feels relatively soulless compared to the days of when I was thinking about this actually last night, how, and I'm probably not the first person to ever say this, is how, I know I'm definitely not, how MMA media and kind of the sport itself kind of started growing together. And everyone was trying to kind of figure things out along the way. Obviously existed for a long time, but, you know, in terms of like the boom period and everything, and how Dana was figuring it out and the UFC was figuring it out in terms of just more attention, more interest, more people that gave a shit in the product. And that with all these different outlets, they're trying to figure out, how do we cover this thing? And how can we just go from maybe, yeah, we're going to cover, you know, the wide spectrum of MMA as it were at the time, to this UFC juggernaut that's growing, and then, you know, acquisitions happen and all that, and just so many different personalities and different flavors and places you could get things. And there was just the place for the hardcores. And then, you know, you get some people that were more kind of the new fans that were over here, and they all kind of just came together in this weird Venn diagram. But Jordan was he was a big part of that. And one of the things I talked about on, I think it was on Tuesday when I recorded that quick episode with the wrestling clip that I shared with you before, that a few people have actually hit me up and were happy to share that. I've wanted to share that for a long time. It's been out there since 2018, but it's one of those things that every once in a while, I'm like, I should just kind of throw that back out there. It was so much of a personality, from his dress to his manner of speaking to how he interpreted it, and just how he's so much different than everybody else. Those are a few things that stood out to me. But obviously, you know, you knew him very well. Do you remember kind of, was Sherdog, when you first started working, kind of came into each other's orbit, or what's your origin story with him, I guess?
Yeah, I started contributing to Sherdog in 2008 on a freelance writing basis, and he was among the freelance writers there. And when TJ DeSantis, who I still work with to this day, and the Lapsed Fan, decided to invite me onto what was called the Sherdog Radio Network, which is sort of pre the term podcast. You know, it was pretty much intended to be consumed live as it happened, as kind of like an afternoon drive time MMA talk concept 5 days a week, including live post shows, which he called Beat Down After the Bell, and Friday afternoon roundtables, which is a situation I ended up in where I was hosting the roundtable for years with Jordan as the absolute cornerstone. You know, there were roundtables without Jordan and there were ones with him. And the ones with him, man, you just set it and forget it, wind him up, let him go. And anything that was worth saying about any fight or fighter on that card would be on that episode. You could guarantee it. He wouldn't accept anything less, of himself at least. And was also incredibly gracious to those who didn't want to match him blow for blow, which only made you even more inspired to learn as much about the sport as he seemed to not only know, but into it. You know, he just seemed to see what was coming around the corner and be able to tie that back to precedents that most people would have never heard of, let alone forgotten about. So when I came, started writing, and I started doing the Sherdog Radio Network, he was among the personalities. Incredibly fondly remembered was his weekly Jordan Breen show, where he just took people down the craziest rabbit holes in MMA. A real, what was so delightful about him is he celebrated in the absurdity of MMA. He celebrated in the fact that this is a sport with its roots in people who should not be on a stage, should not be considered professionals, are just flailing lunatics being put in rings in the middle of bars. Even the initial UFCs in cages with a dojo background that couldn't beat a rabbit in a fight. And here they are getting their faces smashed in on a pay-per-view because the martial art that they had practiced so long had gone untested. And he just knew that heritage, he knew that heart of the sport kept beating, no matter how much of a sheen the UFC was able to put on it as it consolidated its market control. So I was just fixated on what he was, his insights, and wanted to really track like how, what his process was to be able to understand the sport globally and historically like he did. And essentially, you know, it wasn't a pre-YouTube era, but you couldn't reliably track down video of what had happened across the globe in MMA then like you can now. So that's what made his knowledge and astuteness in MMA even more astounding, was that, and a key part of why he was able to be what he was that he had an absolute mastery of where to find pirated video, of where to find live streams of fights going on anywhere in the globe. He was very much part of that community as well. He had a data-driven look at the sport. He was a key architect of the Sherdog Fight Finder in terms of putting the most obscure fights in there and being the kind of person that managers and fighters would email to say, hey, I actually have three fights that aren't on the Fight Finder. They took place here, then, and there. And he and others at Sherdog would take it, assess it, try to find some kind of independent proof that the fight happened the way the person said it did, and add it to the record. And that's just an incredible, you know, legacy for him to have left behind, because there's so much that's known about so many fighters and so many fights that otherwise would have been lost to history if they weren't put into the Fight Finder.
Yeah.
So I'm realizing he's doing all these things and rocking and rolling, and I start reaching out to him and offering praise on some of the writing he did, because he's also a terrific writer in addition to being a great speechifier. And that's what was awesome about this kid was he was doing all this before he was 20 years old in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And he just, you know, was a forum kid. He was a, you know, an MMA underground maven in a time when the sport really thrived in on message boards. And he was able to show how being like an obsessive fan of something like MMA on the message board culture could actually translate into like legitimate podcasting opportunities as podcasting became a thing.
Yeah.
And he also had the gift not only of gab, but of writing. So I was just like, anytime he did something that impressed me, I let him know it. And eventually we found ourselves on the air together. And that's what led to that years long give and take where, you know, so often I would be previewing UFC shows with him for Sherdog.
Yeah. He one thing is, as you mentioned, he was an outsider that found his way in. And he found his way in at a time when such a good portion of the audience was searching for more. They're like, I like this. I need more of it. I need more of it. And your audience grows and more people know you. And he, one thing is, as you're talking about this, he, I don't know what his background was before any of this. Yeah,
That's the thing. He didn't have one. I mean, he was just a really well-read, smart kid who he had an instant he had a photographic memory. He had a depth of knowledge on all things pop culture, literature, music. He had this depth of knowledge on many other things besides MMA, which is even more confounding to think about. He was just a guy that would just he was just such a fan of like internet ephemera. Like there was just if anything had like a cult following on the internet, he knew a lot about it and could find himself on any given day down that rabbit hole. I remember he told me one time that he just decided one day to listen to every episode of This American Life from the beginning to the current day. I was like, how? First of all, that's always the question with him. How? Not just why, how? He figured that how out, no problem. And he had listened to every single episode of that radio show that has been running for what, 20 years on public radio, maybe 30. I don't even know when it started now. I think in the 90s. Just, so that's what he did. He mastered the internet. He didn't have a job that I knew about per se before getting paid to write about and comment on MMA. He was too young.
And how he didn't stammer or anything on air, and I think it may have been a little bit of fake it before you bake it, or once he did. But anytime when he came on my show once, or listened on Sure Dog or other, interviews and things like that, there was never a lack of confidence. There was just a brimming of confidence, and he's like, I know this. And even if for some reason something was wrong, you would know, I have no idea. Or there'd be no like, oh, he got something wrong. Like, oh, he just, whatever. He just knew so much and was so confident in what he knew that you don't see that a lot, especially for someone that hasn't come from like a broadcast background or anything like that. He knew his shit. He knew he gave all. He wasn't like a massively, physically massive figure or anything like that. But he just had this charisma. We talk about wrestling and entertainment also. He had this charisma that made you like, he knows his stuff and I trust him.
Yeah, that was another thing that was remarkable is because he was known as this writer that just had such an amazing command of like Japanese MMA. You would think he was in Japan. I heard from many people who were, tweeting and posting that people thought he was Japanese in the beginning because how much he knew about Japanese MMA all the way down to sea level judo and the full suite of fighters competing in that country. It was just amazing. And so you think this guy's going to be sort of like it could potentially be somebody that's, holed up in a basement, that's the least charismatic person walking. Like, of course, he's like this because that's the extent of things he does and cares about in his life. And then you meet the kid and he comes out of the sort of shadows of internet posting. And Sure Dog started doing video stuff like in studio fight breakdown shows, and their parent company was pushing video. Put the kid in front of a camera. He can do it in front of the camera, and he's got this incredible charisma, like you said, incredible sense of style and fashion. He knew so much about, and I used to talk to him all the time about, not all the time, but I talked to him in many memorable instances about the trends in fashion and clothing. And his haircuts were always wild and always like dialed in. Like they were wild and by design. It wasn't like he was unkempt, but he had like a, I don't even want to put an adjective on it because I'll probably misspeak, but it was kind of like a punkish look, but it was just so like wild to see a person that could somehow manage to know that much about so many things, who also could present as someone who's camera ready in an instant, and who, to your point, spoke in clear diction at all times, demanded that of himself, and that wasn't just on podcasting. I was going back looking at emails we exchanged over the years, instant messages over the years. This guy would write in complete sentences with perfect punctuation. In every instance, no matter how informal the discussion, I'm a writer, but if I'm going back and forth with a friend, and it's not like a professional conversation, I'll let capitalization slide. I'll use some abbreviations. I'll, do some things that I wouldn't do in a professional letter or something. But he always insisted on these clean English sentences that were, it's like he knew no other way. And it was amazing how the depth that he had in that way. And I think that's something very few people saw of him, because you wouldn't know that if you didn't interact with him. And all you saw was his published work. You would think it'd gone through an editing process, and no, it was clean copy. He didn't need to be edited. In fact, he became the administrative editor of SureDog.com. And eventually, when I was writing pieces, he was the one who was editing them and reading them over. and suggesting them and pitching them. I was finding emails where he was like, "You want to write a feature on a year-end awards were big at Sherdog. They would even hand out plaques to some of the fighters." And he's like, "You want to do what was it? Beatdown of the year." And just he gave me so many fun ideas. You know, just run down some interviews and put a piece together that, you know, shined a light on something that happened that people otherwise wouldn't think to write about and slice and dice in quite that way.
Yeah.
So he was a brilliant editorial mind too. It wasn't just his own content that he knew how to perfect. He had such a deep well. There are so many instances I went through with him over the years where we were conceptualizing how to do coverage of MMA. And he always had like six ideas off the top of his head that were fucking brilliant that nobody else was doing in MMA. And it's just, he was always missing the link to the execution. Not that he couldn't execute, he just couldn't execute that many things. But if you put this guy on top of like the ringer would be better, if not substantially better, especially in the MMA vertical. But
Yeah.
anything he knew about, which was all sports, it was unbelievable.
Yeah. Including pro wrestling.
And come to
Yeah.
find out,
Did you have
as
any
I
idea?
did lap, yeah, as I did lapsed fan, he emailed me one time as we were going through every WrestleMania in order. I think I have it here, actually. What did he say? I got to pull it back up. He was like, you know, he had to get such a funny style. So I'm trying to remember what he said. Well, first he wrote because we failed to appreciate that Bruno Lauer had come to WWF in 1992 because of his Memphis history with Sid. We were kind of freeballing on the show and didn't really establish that. And he wrote out of nowhere, "If y'all motherfuckers keep blowing shit on the 80s and early 90s, I'm gonna have to invade your podcast NWO style and do it in black and white audio. How dare you not know that Harvey Whippleman was downtown Bruno and was brought to the WWF with Sid because Sid was his boy from back when Sid did the Lord Humongous Mad Max ripoff gimmick. You're all bitches."
With love.
And essentially, yeah. And I wrote back, I deduced that. And he wrote back, "Jack, I want WrestleMania 4 or Uncensored 1995. That is to say, he wanted the Lapsed Fan to cover those shows. And we did. We did WrestleMania 4. He said, "WrestleMania 4 actually has a real weird place in my heart because I bought the VHS in a store going out of business. And for years, when I didn't have cable in my room, I'd watch it to go to sleep. Seriously, like 30 to 40 nights a year, I'd fall asleep at night to WrestleMania 4. Vanna's leopard print dress is the fucking shit too. Also, you can hear me lose my mind about how I loved Honky Tonk Man as a kid for some weird reason, but kind of hate his guts now, realizing that his dorkery is why Ted DiBiase couldn't have the strap." It's great. So we had him on. We did the show as we usually did it, and at the end we tacked on, you know, whatever it was, 45 minutes with Breen just rapping about WrestleMania 4, saying things you've never heard anybody say about WrestleMania 4, and personalizing it in that way.
Yeah.
And they were, and I was like, "Oh my God, I mean, this kid, this guy, I don't know why I call him a kid because you have to always keep in mind how young he was. He's in his 20s with this kind of mastery. I mean, the poor guy died 38 years old. I mean,
Yeah.
I won't say most of his 30s, but a good chunk of his 30s, he wasn't even contributing, you know, as far as like MMA content.
Yeah.
So when I realized that, I mean, I knew he knew a lot about pro wrestling because he was always one that encouraged me to talk about it on Sherdog Radio, even when a lot of the hardcore MMA fans could not countenance the fact that basically the reason they love MMA, whether they realize it or not, was because they were using pro wrestling's tricks to make them interested in fighters and personalities and stuff. But he was like, "Not only do I love that, but here's my knowledge dump on wrestling." And I heard
Yeah.
your thing about how he described pro wrestling to somebody who'd never heard of it before. A great example of how brilliant he could be.
Yeah, and we were just talking. I think we was on to talk about UFC 119 or 116 and what something like that. And so we started talking about wrestling at the beginning, and yeah, at the time, it, you know, wrestling wasn't as big as it is now, which it was, as you know, it's one of those things you kind of like. You don't admit to people that you're watching. At that point, it was just really like, it was just kind of hard to, MMA was just so much more interesting and acceptable, I guess. And wrestling just
Acceptable
was,
is the word.
yeah. And then, so we started talking about, and that led into that. How he would explain to a non-wrestling fan, someone that came down from an alien, anything like that, how would you explain pro wrestling? They had no idea. And he did that. He went off the cuff and just let him go. And for 4 minutes, it was just, like, that's great. So well thought out. I'm sure he probably thought that speech in his head a million times before. And for the first time, just kind of like, here
Let
we
it
go.
go.
Yeah, here we go.
I feel like he was like AI and that he was generative. He would come up with things like that as he was talking. It wasn't It wasn't like a deep well of things he'd meditated on. You could never have the kind of, you couldn't be as profligate as he was, as prolific as he was, if all you were doing was spouting like fully baked ideas that he had, you know, nursed to into being. He was, his mind worked way too fast. He was literally figuring out how to frame the sentences as the thoughts occurred to him. And you couldn't believe it because it sounds so polished, but I can vouch for it because I know I've threw things at him that there's no way he would have time or prepare to think about. And that's why so many people have used the word intimidating when they talk about being on roundtables with him or on radio shows with him, because it just didn't, you couldn't help but feel underprepared when you were talking MMA with him. But the point is, there wasn't preparation. There wasn't. It was just an incredible gift that he had for retaining nuances, not just facts, but the nuances of why something happened and what the broad sweep was of why we remember what we remember and don't remember what we don't remember, and what the difference is between those things. And he, so he would do that, and he would start rapping, and you would kind of realize that he's generating it as he goes. He's tapping the large language model.
Yeah. I'm sorry to bring it up because I only did one preview show with him, with you and him. We're previewing the UFC's lone trip to Maine, to Bangor, Maine, all those
Yes.
years ago, because I was covering the show. I was running the few MMA media that was there. So, because I went to college there, and I'm like, oh, I have to be there. It's the only time this is going to happen. And yeah, I remember going into that and I had all my notes, and I just knew I'm like, get your few things in and just stay out of the way. You know, don't try to, you know, go over your skis or anything. I just kind of knew because I had so much respect for you anyway, but also for him. I'm just like, I felt so in my depth. I'm like, if you go into it thinking that way, you're going to come out that way. So just do your thing and just don't try to overcompensate and be part of the
Amen.
show. Yeah.
And he respected that too about people. He didn't expect people to have the command he did of MMA. If you said something that he thought was specious, he'd correct it because he was one of the, you know, those types that couldn't, he didn't suffer fools, but at the same time he didn't have like this gate that he erected wherein you had to pass a test to talk MMA with him or be his friend. He was so great about just kind of let welcome you in. I remember I wasn't even on Instant Messenger since like high school, and he was like, "You got to get on AIM," and I was like, "Why?" And I got on AIM with him, and I found out why, because he that's where the back and forth that people talk about was like most unbelievable, was his ability to hold a conversation about anything you would bring up on Instant Messenger in a way where he's writing things to you that you feel like honestly it would take a writer like, you know, significant time to form the thought as cleanly as he did. And he's doing it, you know, like that, like on the fly. We've all had instant messenger conversations over the years, but rarely do you have an instant message conversation where you want to save the thread afterwards for future reference. And
Sure.
he would do that. I forget what the platform was, but they created like a Discord style plug-in Java chat thing in like 2009, 10. I forget what it was called. It was kind of sweeping the internet a bit. And he just took that up. And on Fridays, he did the Jordan Breen chat right before a big MMA weekend. And everybody across, you know, the Sherdog universe would get on there and ask him questions, and he'd just do what he would do in AIM with his colleagues and friends. He would just do, and people still, I saw 100 people, I mean, not literally, but you know what I mean, a bunch of people mention those chats. And I remember actually saving snippets from those chats for, you know, future Sherdog broadcasts where I was like, that was a really cool insight about a fight or a fighter, and no one's going to put it that way again. And I want to grab that and keep it in my file because he just crystallized it. There's no other reason to state it any other way than he did. And it was just a marvel to see, because he's like a creature of a world. He's a creature of a time in internet culture that is thoroughly gone. And I think that's part of the nostalgia we miss. It isn't just the MMA media and what it used to be like that he crystallized. It was also internet culture pre-Twitter. On the vanguard of Twitter, where, you know, there was, it still took a lot of ingenuity to find deep expertise on a subject on the internet. You had to know what rocks to turn over. You had to know what forums to be subscribed to. You had to know how to access the thought streams of, you know, what we would call today thought leaders. But there's no like LinkedIn to say this guy, this woman's the thought leader. There's no Twitter
Yeah.
metric with a certain number of followers that tells you a lot of people turn to this individual for that. You had to be smarter about, and you had to be more well-read to know who to trust and learn from in those days, because it was a free-for-all, and he was someone that could orient himself in that world of a million takes on MMA and other things. He was one of the first people. I mean, one thing I realized when I started doing Sherdog Radio with him was you got to get really good at Googling while you're talking. I was not ready for that. And he was unbelievable at that. I mean, you would realize that he's actually looking things up while he's talking, and you can't tell. You can't tell with a break in his voice. You can't tell with an ellipsis where he's like, I'm pulling something up. But he would be able to do that. He'd power Google before most people even had a command of Google. And he knew kind of what search terms to use to run down those little factoids that you would not be able to find just searching, a broad search like just the name of the fighter. No, forum 2008, this fight, this location, this person used this phrase that I. And it was just, okay, I gotta know how to do that now. I got to get comfortable doing that. And he would do that. He had all kinds of other techniques I felt like, and I sensed, to keep on top of things. A couple of times we got together in person. One time he was at my house watching Bellator prelims, and he was r responsible for doing the play-by-play. I think Sherdog still does this. You just load up a continuous stream of paragraphs of like what's happening in each round of a fight for people who want to follow along but can't or don't want to watch the fight itself. And it was a great repository because it would have every round scored by someone who really knew how to score a round, like really scored a round in a way where, like, if you got it way wrong, the Sherdog readers would just shit all over you, and you just never live it down. So you could trust those. It's kind of like what the most informed fan would have thought of that round, which, of course, is, as we know, is often very different than what the actual officially assigned judges would have seen in any given round, and what the official scorecards would go on to reflect. This is before MMADecisions.com. That's my point. This is before these things were so systematized, before Fight Metric. In fact, Jordan played a critical role in creating the idea of Fight Metric. He consulted with Remy Ganauer and others. He did a panel at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference with Luke Thomas. I got together with them after that because that was in Boston. And he was up there talking about, how do we quantify a significant strike? How do we differentiate a takedown from a this? How do we account for top control? And now the UFC broadcasts are replete with these stats. And I'm here to tell you that, and they basically, from what I understand, bought Fight Metric to be able to do that, or at least got their hands on their model somehow and partnered with them. That those The whole data framework of that stuff is 40% Jordan Breen. I don't think people would quibble with that. He was the person you asked when you had to figure out, like, what makes an MMA round a win for one guy and a loss for another.
Yeah. I was just thinking, if the UFC Hall of Fame was truly legitimate, you could argue potentially pioneer, right? I mean,
I think so.
I know some people, with media people, like, it's whatever, but you just think of it as, influence, and I'm sure there's a lot of people like this, but.
Joe Silva, Sean Shelby, know him very well, know exactly what he understands about the sport. But I don't know the degree to which Dana knows who he is. I don't know. That kind of decision will have to go all the way up the chain,
Sure.
like a TKO. But he did contribute to UFC.com for a little while, a gambling column. People
Oh,
forget
really?
that.
I didn't know that,
Yeah.
huh?
Yep, he did. So he was under the tent to some degree as far as them knowing what he could do. But he was so he was such a truth finder and truth teller. He was like a live wire. You could only let him you could only expect so much out of cozying up to him, because he'd turn right around and put you on blast if that's what the moment called for. He'd spotlight on his Press Row podcast investigative work that was being done by journalists in the space that was just, completely making the sport look like the farce it so often could be, or, adjacent to corruption and shady figures and characters and special interests. He didn't shy away from any of that stuff. And he could have just said, I've got this gift of like seeing the fight game and being able to talk about the fight game in a way that even grizzled fighters have to respect what I see when I watch a fight that they miss. And then he went that step further in terms of intellectual integrity. He went that step further in terms of, like, no, let's actually make sure that this sport is being covered as seriously as, Washington, D.C. is covered by political reporters,
Yeah.
and if things are important, We need to talk about them, not just if they're relevant or top of mind.
So you wrapped up in with Sherdog in what, March 2015-ish? I'm just looking based on
Sounds
articles.
right.
Yeah. How long was he with Sherdog? Did he leave around the same time you
Yeah.
did, or he stick around for a little bit longer?
Around the same time, they had a big like washing out of the whole like original crew and went with a different model, much lower cost model. I think the digital internet proposition, the digital internet advertising proposition shifted under their feet, and it changed the economics of what they were doing. I mean, they were bought out by Crave Online, and when UFC 100 was happening, it was salad days. People wanted to advertise against Sherdog content. They absolutely wanted to. I'm just using UFC 100 as kind of like a high watermark of that boom period you were talking about. But I think as the market evolved and as it got more competitive, there was a lot of other places that you could spend your ad dollar to reach MMA fans. I'm assuming a lot of this. I've talked to folks about it over the years, but I wasn't close to the beating heart of the business model. But like Jeff Sherwood, after who the site was named, when he was let go, it was like, okay, this can't be the Sherdog we knew, because he was the one that actually catalyzed talent like Breen, TJ DeSantis, so many other Jake Rawson, so many people that contributed to that site, Todd as well, although Todd continued to freelance, Todd Martin, who I know you guys know. Jeff was the one that's like, no, I created this, I made it make money. I'm sort of like the kingmaker. Like, if I think it's worthy, we're going to do it. We're going to fly people to Japan. We're going to pay people to cover shows that no one else cares about. And a huge part of this, and it can't go unsaid, is that the UFC would not credential Sherdog from 2006 on, maybe a five. And you can spend 100 hours reading about why and still not get a satisfactory answer as to why. But essentially, as Dana started to, consolidate and move the center of gravity in the sport from Japan to the United States, and started to sign the Crow Cops and started to sign all the Pride guys, Rampage, you started to see, I guess, a bitterness that he couldn't better control the degree to which Sherdog covered UFC over everything else, because he was, as we came to find, he was building the empire in the sport. And he was the future. The way he was building the business was going to kill everybody else, and he was going to have all the best fighters and all the most important fights. But Sherdog thrived in an era where it was so much more fun to be like, actually, no, there's this guy over here in this country who's knocking people out. There's this guy who you've only seen a couple of times in Japan who could beat anybody the UFC's calling a champion right now. The Sherdog top 10 was so important. The rankings were so well read and considered. There was like a panel you had to like weigh in behind the scenes before they came out with the rankings. And those fighters who weren't with the UFC through 06, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, who weren't in the UFC but still ranked top 10, that's where the money was. That's where the energy was in the sport. It was like, no, man, this guy can beat everybody in the UFC, or he can beat their champion, or he's just as good in the weight class. And as that started to become less and less the case, I feel like the idea of hardcore MMA fandom became less and less fun, because there was less discoverability to it. It was more like, okay, well, UFC tells me who the top 10 are. When they instituted their own top 10 system, I think that probably was a key moment. Even if people didn't necessarily put a lot of stock in those rating, the rankings, the way the UFC first conceptualized them when they went to Fox in, I think, 2011, the fact that the UFC now had that signpost of who the best was that you could look up as a fan took that away from Sherdog. That was Sherdog's dominion. That's where everyone turned to. Who are the top 10 best fighters in the weight class and why? And that's where you went, and that changed.
So one of the reasons I asked was because, Jordan was so synonymous with Sherdog. And one of the sentiments that's come up this week is, I haven't heard that name in years. And a lot of people hadn't. He wasn't he the last he did some stuff for Fight through the years, Fight Magazine, because I was going through my emails. There was a few things that he and I were on the same email thread about, because I did a bunch of stuff for Fight for years. He did work for Bloody Elbow,
Yes.
which seemed like a great transition in terms of a, at that point, more of an independent view of the sport. Not, different, similar to Sherdog, I guess, in some ways, but different in some ways, but much different than some of the other outlets. And then that was it. I think I he just kind of just disappeared, and here we are.
Yeah, he sure did. Chuck Mendenhall did a piece. Mike Bond, who was a much better friend to Jordan than a lot of his admirers, both being Torontonians, and John Pollock to some degree as well, from what I understand. But I know
Yes.
Mike Bond in particular really took up the cause to go the extra mile to keep in touch with Jordan and try to understand what he was up to. And you can find what Mike has said at MMA Junkie. Mike is at MMA Junkie about, or was at the time, I'm not sure right now, but about what happened with Jordan and the troubles he ran into. I mean, all I can say is I always worried that he, to be Jordan Breen, was potentially a burden at some point for your calling card through your 20s when other people might be kind of figuring out, like, a career that paid well and kept the lights on. And he just doubled down on being Jordan Breen. And I'm not sure you can be Jordan Breen without eventually having some dependency issues. I mean, the people have talked about it came out over time, that he struggled with substance abuse. And I got firsthand sense of that. And I swear to God, you can ask people that I used to talk to about him from the very beginning. I said, this is the kind of deal where, like, you can't sleep and be Jordan Breen. And it sounds like it's so refreshing that so many people have come out and tributed him the way they have, because you realize so many people felt the same about him. To say these things about him before he passed, I think would have been received with kind of like a askance. Like, really? Like, this guy was just, in the internet, writer about a sport, and it was years ago. But when you realize that everyone felt the same way about him, you feel almost emboldened to put him on more of a pedestal, because it's where he belonged. And we're realizing that now, and that's how life is. You don't know how to put the words to it until you get that sort of tailwind of he's gone. He's gone. So now we have the wind at our back for these thoughts that might have sounded cheesy to come out beforehand, to come out about this guy. Because you now can set down a conclusion and say, yes, this is now what he meant, even if, sadly enough, there isn't a catalyst to put these thoughts to paper, or on the internet before you lose him. But that's always the catalyst. That's why obituaries are so important, because it's in that moment of immediate grief that you really find yourself putting the words to things and find community and other people trying their best to put their words to it. And then you find the commonalities. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. When he was at my house doing the play-by-play, I abandoned the story as far as the point of it. He was talking to me on the couch, conversing like he was just hanging, but he was still somehow paying attention to the fights on the TV. I don't know how he was doing it, and typing out what was happening to the satisfaction of Sherdog readers who wanted to know what was going on with these Bellator prelims. But I didn't sense that I had to sit there and kind of let him focus and concentrate on his work. It was communal. And I thought that that was just like a one of a kind kind of look into who he was. But sure enough, as I hear, I think Mike Bond mentioned it, some others mentioned it as well. I think John Pollock even mentioned it. They saw the same thing from him. They happen to be in a position where they're talking to him and he's watching fights and kind of chronicling them for the website. And they thought the same exact thought. And I thought, no one's ever going to think that about this guy besides me, because he was just there at my house and it was just one time, circumstances dictated that he had to do this. But no, that's what someone passing does. It brings the stories out. So you can go, okay, six other people felt the same way I did. 10 other people noticed the same things I noticed. I thought it was just me. And so you hold those things in because you don't want to be the only person to say something about somebody. And it's just like, well, calm down, dude. Geez, he wasn't Socrates, but and so that's why it feels so good to be able to talk about someone in a situation like this, because that you're in good company when you praise somebody.
When was the last time you talked to him or communicated
That's
with
a
him?
good question. I would say, I don't know, because it wasn't time stamped, like it wasn't like an email,
Oh, okay.
So I struggle to remember. I would say around 16, 17, maybe.
So it's been a while.
Definitely before COVID.
Okay. Interesting.
And I think you'll find that's the case with people who try to stay in touch with him on a weekly basis as well.
Yeah. Any unsaid things, any stories that you remember favorably, or I'm favorably, whatever you want to say, any final thoughts about Jordan, your many experiences with him, good stories or anything like that?
Yeah.
You mentioned the Boston trip. I do remember, 'cause I was covering for this website, I think, at that point,
Sure.
and I saw the picture of you and him and Luke at that bar, and 'cause I remember seeing you there and other places and things like that, kind of brought me back. But yeah,
Yeah.
thoughts in general, any experiences, anything like that?
That's a great question. As far as narrowing it to things that I think would be unique to my experience of the guy. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the car with him on that trip because I was glad to drive him around, you know, so we wouldn't have to pay for taxis to get to his hotel. I think he stayed in Cambridge, which is way the fuck away from
Yeah.
where the convention was, and we just wrapped with the windows down. It was just like great. We were just talking about all manner of shit, hanging out. And I only had like, you know, a handful of times to get to do that. I remember one time I wasn't in there in person, but he was interviewing Marlos Kunin, who you might remember
Yes.
as a Strike
Yeah.
Force contender, Dutch fighter, very nice woman from what I could tell. And he started asking her questions about her fights with Cindy Dandois and like Belgian MMA from like 10 years before anyone knew who she was. And she didn't, I don't think she knew who Jordan was, because the look on her face, and it was on video, I remember it, was just like, is this guy like stalking me almost? Like, how does somebody remember these things I forgot about things I did? And it wasn't on TV. I mean, it was videotaped, obviously he saw it, but it wasn't like a flashpoint in her life or career. I mean, it was the first time she had had a fight that I think people considered competitive enough to wonder how far she could go. I just remember that as like, that is so Breen, you know, like remembering things about, he had Dale Hart on after Corey Hills kicked him in the leg and snapped his leg. Remember when Corey Hills' leg,
Yes, of
you know,
course.
disintegrated on TV? Dale Hart was the fighter that checked that kick. I think he's from Maine, actually. And Dale Hart went on the Jordan Breen show and just said some of the funniest things about, obviously, it's a tragedy what happened to Corey Hill's leg, but just being the person that did that to him without intending to. I just remember Dale Hart said, "Oh shit, oh fuck," the way he was describing what was going through his mind when it happened. And Jordan got that out of the guy. And, you know, everyone's going to want to interview Corey. No one's going to interview Dale about that moment, Dale Hart
Sure.
about that moment. And what you remember about that moment is what Jordan got out of Dale Hart. He could extract things from his interview subjects. He was awesome, awesome at that. I remember I saw him talking to somebody. We did the Sherdog Fighter Exchange in 2011 in conjunction with EA Sports. They just come out with their EA MMA game, and they sent some Sherdog writers to different camps. I went to Japan, where God, it was, I went with Luke Rockhold and Wayne Phillips, who was at AKA at the time, who was kind of like a Strike Force prelim guy and just trying to make it in the sport. And Jordan did an interview with him in San Jose before we left. That was the KJ Nunes Nick Diaz rematch fight. Because first time I met Dave actually was there at the SAP Center.
Oh,
Very,
yeah.
very fleetingly. I shook his hand as I was on the move. And during that thing, he asked like Wayne a bunch of questions about his tattoos. No one had ever seen Wayne before. And Jordan knows about his tattoos. And he just met this guy. And he's asking him a big meandering question. Meandering, I don't mean that derogatorily, but it's a layered question about the meaning of his tattoos. And again, this guy was just like, didn't even know how to respond. Like, because you're still trying to process how he can know that much about you to even ask that question. It's similar to, oh, I'm going to botch the name. I'm going to try to look it up real quick in the time we have left. There's this guy who interviews hip hop guys. And he's like a gimmick. He's oh my God. People who know what I'm talking about are screaming at their phones right now. Well, you're DaBaby. We gotta know. He's a guy, he puts on a gimmick like he doesn't. It's almost like the guy in MMA who has like a,
The Shmo.
yeah, the schmo, thank you. He's got like a personality, he's got a gimmick to his approach. But this guy like knows everything about these hip hop artists, and he goes up to them and he interviews them, and he mentions things from like middle school. Like they'll mention a name of like a project they did when they were in ninth grade, and they'll just look at him like, what? How do you even know about that? That's of all the things Jordan was in MMA, that's what I remember uniquely, is when he was able to do that to fighters.
Yeah.
and blow their minds at how much he knew about what they had done before they thought anyone cared.
Yeah. Pete Carroll actually mentioned that the other day. He was on with Ariel and they were talking about Jordan. And Pete's like, I remember, and he's like, I was talking about something Irish MMA related, some prelim fighter. And I was talking, Pete's an expert in this. And Jordan corrected him. And Pete's like, oh, yeah, you're right. this is something he's supposed to know about cold. And Jordan just completely is like, well, actually, I think it might be this. And he's like, oh, you're right.
Yes, exactly. And he would issue the correction and you would accept the correction, and he would do it with a little bit of attitude, but it was a well-meaning attitude. It was kind of like, let's tighten up here. Like, if we're going to talk about MMA, let's know what the fuck we're talking about, and let's not just talk out of our ass, okay? Because this sport deserves a little bit more care than that. And I think to this day, it's lacking in MMA coverage and how people talk about the sport. The banal kind of sweeping commentary is won out over the detailed, witty, biting kind of voice that Jordan represented. That's all but gone from the sport.
The one other note I had as we were talking, I just remembered from an interaction with Jordan. I had when I was really kind of young in doing this, I reached out to him and just offered. I can't remember if it was after the panel or some other interaction. And I said, if you ever need a guest or if you ever short notice, anything like that, like let me know anytime. I'm willing to help. And I can't remember what else he said, but he said no in a way of saying, I don't answer the door when it knocks. I'm the one
Yes.
who knocks or something like that. And I was
Yes.
like, okay, I have never forgot that for the rest of my life. And
Yes.
it wasn't a mean way. It's just kind of like, if you're worthy, I'll find you at some point. Somewhere down the road, I'm like, all right, now, all these years later, I can completely appreciate it. I would use that to say to somebody, but that was just
Yes.
very uniquely him from what I've heard.
Yeah, he'll come knocking if circumstances are ripe for you to collaborate. But he'll be the determinant of that. Thank you very much. Like, I know Felix Biederman, who does Chapo Trap House, an immensely successful political podcast, if you want to call it political. I'm sure he'd bristle at that. But Felix started out as a Jordan Breen fan, and first time I ever heard of the
Really?
guy. Yeah, because he wrote Fighting in the Age of Loneliness. He created like this documentary called Fighting in the Age of Loneliness, and it was a multi-part thing, and it's
Oh, is
pretty
that with
wild.
John something? I've heard of that. Yes, yes,
Have you?
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he's just, Felix is also brilliant in terms of, and just like searing insight into the culture and into, how politics affects culture. And a game, like a crazy gamer guy, knows all about games and all about like weightlifting and stuff. And he was on, first time I ever heard of him was on Jordan Breen's Cheap Seats podcast, where he'd bring on members of the media to spotlight work they'd done. But that's to your point. After they'd done the work, he'd have you on. Now there's work to talk about. It isn't just we're going to sit around and chit chat. There's something we're putting on the table to elucidate. That's out there in the ether. We're not just hanging out. And that's he wouldn't pick up the mic. I mean, except for his own show, which was kind of a chatty show with TJ. He wouldn't pick up the mic unless there was something consequential happening. And I learned that from him. When I really thought back on it, I learned how to have a show that where your voice is enough and you're not just the success of your show is not tethered to the profile of your guest. The success of your show is tethered to the degree to which you can convince people that you're worth listening to about the subject, and that you're going to notice things they didn't notice even as closely as they watch. And that is so rewarding if you're a serious fan of something. And the serious fans are the ones I think worth catering to, even if the media superstructure disagrees. But as we're seeing kind of niche obsessions become like the way the media is adjusting to monetize. Like, you have to narrow cast now. You have to, even the New York Times has 100 different newsletters targeted at little slivers of interest, because that's where the money is. If you can convince people in those slivers, and particularly the ones that might be moneyed among them, people that are in positions of influence in industry, that you're a place to go to get answers to questions that are relevant to you that you haven't thought to ask yet. That's where the media evolves. Jordan would have fit beautifully into that structure. But he was kind of saying these niche things into a Sherdog was a very safe space for that, but it was into a headwind of like an MMA that was becoming more and more mainstream, more and more ESPN, more and more national. and people who barely knew anything about it, but were national sports television personalities, were on desk shows talking about it and things like that. It was kind of shifting away to like, well, we have to make it much more general appeal. And that's not why MMA got to where it was. It got to where it was because of the niche, one of a kind appeal that it really has. And Jordan was, he was the keeper of that bolus of knowledge and that style.
Yeah. Fighting in the Age of Loneliness. Yeah. Felix Biedermann and John Boyce. John, also, I believe I'm pronouncing his last name right, part of SB Nation.
John Boyce. Yeah, that's
Yeah.
right.
Secret Base. They did this history of the Seattle Mariners, all this stuff. And it's such a unique style. I need to watch this again. But if people listening to this have not watched that, it's on YouTube. It is, it's unlike
That's one
a.
of the ships that Jordan helped launch. Let's
That's
put it that way.
incredible. Yeah. That's
I'm
incredible.
sure Felix would agree.
Yeah.
Felix did a really nice post about Jordan this week, as did so many. It's amazing.
Yeah, what a legacy. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. I'm glad I'm glad you reached out even after, I know you initially were just like, I'm not so sure, but I'm glad you reached out and you said you want to share some thoughts because you were so associated with them and so eloquent yourself and such a big part of that era. Yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts, and I know a lot of people will like to hear them as well. So, Jack Encarnacio, greatly appreciated. Really quick, a Laps fan, interesting stuff coming up in the week ahead as we
Oh,
make
sure.
that
Yeah.
transition. Yeah.
Always worth tucking in.
Yeah, right.
I just
All
want to say in
right.
conclusion, I feel very lucky to have known Jordan and very lucky that Jordan deemed me worthy to engage with on the topics we engaged on because I got a lot out of those interactions. I learned a lot about how to do this kind of microphone work from him lighting the path to say, actually, you can talk about the most esoteric stuff you could possibly think of that you think has no relevance to anybody else besides you, and you'll find your people. You'll find your people out there who share your same perspective. Laps fans a lot like that. I mean, as you know, we spend so much time just bullshitting and saying crazy shit and like talking about these weird little peccadilloes of watching wrestling over the years that you think you're the only person that ever noticed this or the only person that ever hummed this to yourself when they played a. I used to think Big Boss Man's theme song said he carries a fish stick, a ball and chain too, which, he carries a big stick is what it said. But to this day, and sure enough, I say something like that on the show, and people are like, oh my God, this is my version of that. I thought this entrance said this. When you learn what the actual lyrics are, it's like, oh man, no, I'm not gonna. That still says he carries a fish stick. It still does, and I'm sure he did carry many fish sticks. I mean, the guy was like 350 pounds, but he carried them and then stuffed them down his face, no question about it. But yeah, so that is all. That's all kind of Jordan Breen, like showing how you could broadcast about that crazy shit. You could actually, it wasn't just something you bullshit around with your friends. There's actually an audience for bringing those thoughts out about something you're passionate about, and spend so many hours watching. So yeah, on Laps Fan, we just wrapped up. The final episode hasn't dropped yet, but it's coming. A tribute to Sabu. His passing kind of sparked one of our signature go through his matches in order and hit the high points, hit the feuds, try to explain and crystallize why this guy's remembered. So that was fun and challenging because, my co-host JP, what's unique about him in a lot of ways in the wrestling space is he wasn't an ECW fan. Not, it wasn't by choice. It just didn't really cross his transom during the Attitude Era and in the 90s. Whereas I was going to ECW shows all the time and, trying to buy stuff from RF Video as much as I could. I was over the moon when I was able to buy their third pay-per-view because then my cable system didn't carry the first two. So it's great to be able to have like a voice that just is coming at Sabu relatively cold. Like what does Sabu look like to someone who doesn't really have any orientation, but who knows wrestling really well, but doesn't have any orientation about the impact he made when he made it, is only watching it now in retrospect. And that's something I'm always glad to be able to do is bring that. It's a true lapsed fan perspective. That's what he brings. I'm
Yeah.
still, I can articulate why I feel like the way the business was set up was superior in days gone by, and the way the fans were and the way the fans received the product and the state of kayfabe was superior. But he like legitimately is like seeing this stuff for the first time and reacting in a way that's hard to find these days. Because like, who the fuck would have a podcast about wrestling if they're not watching wrestling,
Sure.
18 hours a day.
Sure.
So that was fun to go through Sabu's like explaining to someone who doesn't really get it. It's kind of like how Jordan would hold court, Like explain to me like why people remember this or why it's worth remembering. And that's kind of the dynamic we found ourselves in when it came to introducing to him, at least, and a lot of our listeners too, I'd imagine, some of the more impactful things Sabu did and what those key moments were, where it's like, okay, there he innovated that, there he innovated that. This feud set Rob Van Dam on his way. This feud set Abyss on his way, you know, and Taz on his way. And again, just like with Jordan, it's like when he dies, it comes out. You know, when you see Taz at ringside at AEW getting tearful about the fact that, you know what, if, now I can really say it because it's coming out, and everyone that's coming out, everybody else, that if it wasn't for Sabu taking my suplexes the way he did, if it wasn't for Sabu allowing me to be the menace in our feud, I'm not Taz. It's important. It's important to say those things out loud and not just kind of know them, but keep it to yourself.
And also for those that are on YouTube, you can watch now the entire Dark Side of the Ring Unheard series, the companion
Yes.
series to this past season of Dark Side of the Ring, which just wrapped up last week or so, give or take. But yeah, I've been checking those out along the way. A lot of fun, a lot of
Thanks,
laughs.
man.
It's always fun to watch Evan with the computer and the clips and what JP is wearing and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And you're the anchor in the storm. All these things kind of going on around you. I'm always looking at the set, and I have so many questions about the set in the background, like, was that stuff just things just collected at flea markets and yard sales and things like that for years? Is that set up all the time? Like all those things. That was pretty fascinating. Just kind of looking at these Easter eggs all around.
Yeah, I'll give you a quick one. I mean, it's a studio we rented. Great guy runs it. I was very happy to work with him. And, you know, they have shelves and they have you bring your own stuff. And I brought a garbage bag full of stuff.
Oh, that's all your stuff.
Yeah, and Evan's stuff. Evan's got some wonderful collectibles. Yeah, he's got
Okay.
some great stuff over the years.
Yeah,
Yeah, you see a lapsed fan sign in the background. That obviously is we obviously brought that. You know, that's
yeah.
not there.
Find that at a
You
flea market? That'd be
right.
hilarious.
You can be forgiven for not knowing that we did it in a studio that a ton of podcasts record in. So it's like you know what I mean? You kind of move in for a little while and then move
Sure.
out. Yeah. He
Yeah.
brought the TV and everything. And yeah, so those little, you know, he had the Road Warrior figures, the Remco Road Warrior figures from AWA days and like a plastic case, like so they can't be disturbed. Evan's a Minneapolis guy. So he's got a soft spot for the Road Warriors. And one of their episodes, season two, was, you know, the rise and fall. We did
Yes.
an Unheard on Joe Laurinaitis in season one, which was audio only of Unheard. Because before Animal died, the whole episode was like, you know, Animal reflecting on Hawk because Hawk was gone. You know, it was almost like the episode is just much about Hawk. You know, you could have called it the Hawk episode as the Road Warriors episode. And then what do you know? That's we're probably, you know, if we do it again, you gotta think Sabu, right? These people that
Yeah.
they get time with and on camera with no sense that like they could be gone by the time the next season comes around. We got that with
Yeah.
Kevin Sullivan this season. We got that with Lanny Poffo this season. People who they had in their archives, and just when they pass, it's like, all right, well, this is the last kind of tribute we're going to get. This is the last iteration, right? We're going to get from this person.
Yeah, the Abdul looking at his eyes. That was good. Just look staring at his eyes and like just try to get the pause. You pause it just right, and it's just the psychopath. And he's just trying to intimidate the camera crew, and then the Kim Wood one, which you had talked about, was going to be really
Was very
good.
glad Dave checked that out.
I told him to. I'm sure other people did too, but I remember just because I never heard of him before. He had started talking about for the Dark Side of the Ring and all this stuff. He's talking about this guy, Kim Wood, and then he was on Wrestling Observer Radio,
Yes.
and then I'm like, I watched that YouTube. I watch it right downstairs, and I immediately like, I'm sure you've heard these stories before, but if you find time, watch this, and I guarantee there's some stuff in here you haven't heard him say before. It's really good. So I think I heard him talk about it in Wrestling Observer Radio or something along those lines. But he seemed to
Excellent.
enjoy that. He gets a kick out of Kim Wood.
Yeah, if you're going to check it out after hearing this, do know that the conceit of Unheard isn't necessarily that it's never been said. It's just that it didn't make the episode that the person sat down to be interviewed for of Dark Side of the Ring. So 98% of the things you'll hear on Unheard was not included in the episode itself, right? But they could have done a series of other interviews where they've told the story. That's not disqualifying. I mean, if we made that the standard, this is something this person never said. It would just be a show about what they had for lunch that day that they happened to. You know, these are wrestlers. They're going to tell the story a million times. But
Yeah.
to your point, when you those guys are so good, the Dark Side guys are so good at framing the shot, at getting that detailed profile right up in the person's face in a way that doesn't reduce their natural kind of instinct, and you can see these ticks, you can see these kind of tells, and it's actually rewarding to slow the tape down sometimes. Be like, oh, look there, look how his tone changed, look how he looked to the side, like
Yes. Yep.
Abdullah the Butcher, like searching the room. How do I address that these guys I don't know are showing up and asking me what a work is or what a shoot is, you know? It's so cool. Just to your point, I'm glad you enjoyed that part of it, because some people were kind of belly aching about us stopping the clips to make comments instead of just letting the clips play. It's like, dude, I get it.
That's the whole point. That's the whole
You want to
fucking
see just
it's
the
the whole
rest of them
fucking
talk.
point.
And if it was just the clips, it would be 5 minutes. And if that's what you want, then, you know, fine. But that's not what you're going to get. You're going to get what we want. And that's very important to remember.
Good. I'm looking forward to hoping a next season next year, and we'll see what happens with that. But Jack, again, big thanks for stopping by and remembering Jordan Breen.
Yeah, thanks so much for the platform. And thanks to guys like John Pollock and Chuck Mendenhall for putting pen to paper about Jordan Peetze. I got to check out what he said too. I know Ariel had some things to say, but it really brought back that era that is gone. I mean, I never even think about trying to cover a UFC anymore, you know? It's just the community is not there. It's probably a whole new generation, and respect to those guys and women that are doing it, but man, to get together at an MMA show, not even UFC necessarily, you know, a Bellator or a Strikeforce, Esther Lynn, Casey Lydon, who are also very close with Jordan, even closer than I was with Jordan, definitely. They spent a lot of good time on the road together. Just wonderful memories of a time that you could kind of be guerrilla journalists and still get close enough to these fighters. You know, you had to chase them down the hotel. If it was a UFC show, you weren't credentialed. You couldn't go to the press conference. You couldn't approach these guys in the structured format. You had to literally run them down, but they had enough respect for Sherdog, many of them, that they'd give you some time. But you had to chase them down. And that breeded a certain attitude that I think is gone from the sport
I would
and
agree.
how it's covered.
I would agree. All right, Jack, thanks so much.
Thanks, man.
All right, big thanks to Jack for stopping by. As always, very first guest in this podcast, very likely to be the very last one when this series wraps up at some point. But yeah, it was a lot of fun talking to Jack about obviously a serious subject and an emotional one as well. And I appreciate his time, and I appreciate your time for listening. And I'm going to listen to some other stuff as well. I know some of the content that we talked about, Jack and I, you may have checked out some columns and so on and so forth. We recorded that on Thursday afternoon. It is Friday afternoon as I'm recording this. Luke Thomas just posted some thoughts that he had about working with Jordan throughout the time. So I need to check that out at some point this afternoon or even tomorrow. And yeah, that should be a good 1 week tribute to Jordan Breen. Really deserves a lot more than that. But it's kind of fun just learning about all these different things. I have it up here that fighting in the art of loneliness, or fighting in the age of loneliness rather. And I completely forgot about that series, enjoying it so much. So we'll be checking that out at some point as well. As far as yours truly, I'll be back on Wrestling Observer Live. It appears throughout the entire month of June. It looks like Andrew Zarian's going to be out of action here for a little bit in terms of the audio end of things. He is very busy, and he gets some work stuff and real life work stuff, all that. So yeah, I guess I'm going to be with you every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Wrestling Observer Live. Of course, you can check all the action out usually a little bit earlier on WrestlingObserver.com. Show is not fully live when I'm on it, not at that point yet, but maybe someday. But usually record just a few hours before, try to capture all the news of the day and the weekend and all those things. But yeah, you can check me out the rest of the month on there. And then also look to be doing some other podcasts here as well. And of course, on the website, WrestlingObserver.com. So have a great weekend. And again, big thanks to Jack and Carson Encarnacio. Big thanks to all you. You have a lot of choice in your podcast day, so I greatly appreciate the time you spend with me on this show. Thanks again. And until next time, insert catchphrase here.
The thing about pro wrestling's design now, when I say it's gotten vain and the conceit is over the top, is this is the way I explain it to people. Imagine, Josh, for a second, that you'd never seen pro wrestling. You're aware of what amateur wrestling is. You're aware of how television works, but you'd never actually seen pro wrestling before. Someone's going to pitch to you a pro wrestling product. It would sound like the most stupendously, flagrantly stupid, asinine idea you'd ever heard in your life. Well, I have an idea for a television show. All right, well, tell me more. Well, it's essentially an athletic competition, more or less. Well, what kind of sport? Have you seen amateur wrestling? Yes, I have. I love the Greco-Roman and the freestyle. I actually wrestled D1 myself. Great. Well, it's kind of like that, but not at all. Instead of singlets and stuff and real athletes, I'm thinking failed football players, bouncers, and gymnasts, roided to the gills, and they're going to do more Cirque du Soleil type stuff with an emphasis on pain. High amplitude everything. Not so much real mat work. Okay, well, I mean, how do they pull that off? Well, I mean, it's all scripted, but yeah, they're going to be throwing each other through tables, chairs. Well, that sounds incredibly dangerous. Oh yeah, they're all going to be hooked on painkillers and on drugs. Of course, who could ever carry this out without doing that? Well, I mean, that sounds awfully difficult. I mean, how do you? I'm thinking to start 3 to 6 hours a week live. At this point, someone's brain would already be spinning. And then when you're like, and I'm thinking, you know, obviously it just can't all be people going in and power bombing each other. So thinking a lot of interview segments, a lot of soap opera type stuff, you know, drama. All right, so that's scripted too. Yes. And I'm thinking we go all out. Everyone's in pleather, glitter, wigs, face paint, masks, funny facial hair, over the top, pure pantomime, pure camp. Okay, I'm still with you, I think. And again, obviously, lots of drama, so lots of dialogue. Okay, so these are trained actors as well. No. Like I said, they're former bouncers and football players. So you have an idea for a product where it is essentially half acting done by non-trained actors who certainly aren't coming from any sort of background that would give them a leg up in the charisma and telegenic department. And then when they're not doing that, they're going to be working out, getting juiced to the gills, and firing their bodies like human projectiles through canvas, tables, fire, thumbtacks, light tubes, ladders. And you want to put it live on TV one, two, maybe three times a week. Yes. And I want people to pay for it sometimes on Sunday. And when we're not doing that, we're going to tour 300 days a year. This is literally the craziest thing that you could ever explain to someone. And yet it is a tried and true beloved Western pastime.
Very true. Very true.
So, I mean, just the design of pro wrestling is so over the top at this point in time that I can't imagine being the person who can soak it all in. And so I look at someone, you know, like Meltzer or like Todd Martin or John Pollock and Wei Ting from the Fight Network and this thing. Or, I mean, yourself too, being on both sides of the fence. I don't know how, you know, you can keep even a decent fluency of one and the other, especially with pro wrestling being such a demand.